Week 4, Mindfulness Applied. I just want to begin by saying that today's shiur is dedicated to David ben Eliyahu, whose yahrzeit is today. And we wish the family, the Aaron family, lots of only good things and long life, and the neshama should generate much blessing. I want to just spend a few minutes, as I always do, just reviewing briefly what we've done, particularly up to now, but particularly over the last week. So we were talking about, the series is based about the how, sort of some of the strategies of putting mindfulness in place and implementing it, particularly with regard to thoughts that distract us learning how to let go. So we've established that we all experience periods of distraction which come from negative thinking patterns that sort of threaten us and bring us down and prevent us and block us from focusing, being present in the now, getting the full potential and meaning and purpose out of the moment that we're involved in, out of the things that we want and should be doing at that moment. So we established that one of the concepts of these many thoughts that often come because of things that happen unexpectedly, and that could be from incidents that happen or tragedies, God forbid, or personality weaknesses that come from within, like jealousy and resentment and worry and anxiety and unforgivingness and all the things that we've talked about over the last couple of weeks. But we also established an important principle that we have the two souls within us, the godly soul and the animal soul. And one of the concepts is understanding where those thoughts come from, that not necessarily every thought comes from the same source, but within us, we've got that drive within us that tries and sometimes by design is there to create that struggle and to stop us from getting meaning and purpose out of the life experience by standing in the way and trying to distract us. So last week we dealt particularly with what we called the intruders, the intruding thoughts, or as we call them, the stories that are in our mind constantly that swirl around our mind based on, some of it was based on the book by Russ Harris on that basis on a mindfulness model based on ACT, which is acceptance, commitment therapy, and so on. And we said that the first step, we dealt with different approaches last week, but we said the first step is the art of noticing, which is actually being aware that we're being distracted. Sometimes we just go through this smog and this haze of thought patterns, and we don't even realize that we're being so distracted, and we kind of wake up half a day later, and we don't know what we've done, and we've been irritable and not focused, and so on and so forth. So we have to notice those thoughts, and we notice them and identify them, using his analogy of the bus, identifying them as the noisy passengers that are there to annoy the driver, so to speak, right? And last week we defined a distracting thought, because sometimes it's subtle, we need to understand what a distracting thought is, that often in life we have a mission, we have a goal, and a distracting thought might be a good thought, it might be something that's really worth thinking about tomorrow or later on today, but right now it's there distracting us from the goal. So if it's getting in the way of the current goal or the current focus, then it's a distracting thought and needs to be dealt with. So very briefly, last week, we talked about two approaches. One was learning to challenge our thinking. In other words, if the thinking pattern comes because of a belief system that we have that is born out of an experience or born out of something that's happened, then we need to challenge our thinking. I mean, just very quickly, we went through the ABC model, which is based on how to reframe things, which is the ABCD, the antecedent, the thing that happens, the person that cuts off the traffic, the person that insults us, the thing that someone said to us, and so on. And then it's the belief that we develop because of what happened. And then there's the consequence, which is our feeling of anger, or feeling of resentment, and so on. But what we tried to establish was that what we feel and think doesn't come from what happened, but comes rather from what we believe happened, meaning that our interpretation of what happened, our judgment of what happened, right? And therefore, sometimes what we need to do is we need to bring in the D, which is to dispute that and reframe that and maybe say, well, maybe that person didn't intend it the way we think they intended or didn't quite happen the way we thought it happened, and therefore we change our way of thinking, our belief system, and therefore that sort of challenges the thinking and hopefully leads to better thoughts and more positive thoughts and gets the thought out of being a distracting one. However, we also explain that sometimes that doesn't help because sometimes the thoughts that swirl around in our mind have nothing to do with things that happen. They're just weaknesses in our personality, which God designed each of us to have, different ones, but we each have them, which are designed to create a struggle, and the struggle, as we'll talk about later again today, is there to make us stronger. So when those thoughts are just there, if we by nature like to worry, or by nature we're very judgmental or unforgiving and so on and so forth, then it doesn't help, because it's not actually coming out of any particular incident, and therefore it doesn't help to challenge them, and therefore we just have to learn to let go. And we went to that fusion and defusion thing that Russ Harris talks about, which is just learning to detach, which last week we explained, first, the best way to do it is first of all to get into that let go model, and I went through that breathing concept last week, where we learned to let go, hold it in, let go the toxicity, and imagine as if we're letting go. It's a very, very powerful, powerful exercise. But then also to have things that we like to think about which are positive, that will replace those thinking patterns. And then finally, last week we said that the best way to deal with this in either approach is also to use the power of action. The power of action is that whatever the distracting thoughts are, we also need to jump to action, just do something positive, do something focused, do something to help someone, do something which is brings us back to the present and builds up that concept of presence within us, because action often impacts the heart. As we've said many times, the heart follows the action. Okay. Now, I want to share today three important perspectives. But before I do that, I want to just review and clarify something. Because we talked about the struggle, right? The struggle that we all have. And it bothers us sometimes that why we have that struggle. And some people complain about that inner struggle that often comes up, whether it's worry, whether it's lack of clarification, whether it's confusion, whatever the struggle that we struggle with. But often we have incidents or periods where weaknesses in our personality cause us to have that inner struggle. And that inner struggle comes with many, many distracting and intruding thoughts that stops and blocks us from focusing and being present. So, we talked about that struggle being part of God's design, and I want to just clarify that a bit and understand the purpose of that struggle. As much as we would like the struggle not to be there, and as much as we would prefer that things just go smoothly, that we wake up in the morning and things will happen the way we expected them to happen, or things will be as positive as we wake up with, assuming that we wake up positively, which doesn't always happen, but let's say we do. Let's say we reach the point where we wake up in the morning with the, you know, Modeani, as we talked about many, many times, with full of gratitude and thanking God for the new day and the new soul that we have, and the fact that we can actually live and breathe and put on clothing and so on and so forth. And we have that positive freshness of the mind, the beginner's mind, as we talked about last time. We sort of hope that the day is just going to continue that way and just going to, we'll just be the upbeat. And it doesn't work like that somehow. Somehow, often, things happen that spark or ignite struggle. I'm not even talking about incidents that happen which are harsh or negative. I'm talking about just things that happen to us that cause us to worry, that cause us conflict, relationship issues, whatever the cases are, that ignites within us a certain level of struggle. And we wish that we wouldn't have them. In fact, as I've said many, many times, we pray not to be tested, right? We pray to God every day. It's part of the daily prayers. We say, "Al tivi'enu l'dei nisayon," do not test us, simply because we're not sure if we'll pass the test. And yet, it happens. It happens because it's there by design. It happens because, going back to the principle, that we have in us two drives. There's a drive that is a positive drive, the godly soul, that drives us towards being motivated to find meaning and purpose and positivity into our world, to bring purpose into our existence, bring spirituality into who we are. It's a wonderful, amazing, positive drive. But by design, God also put into us that negative drive. We call in the Gemara, the Talmud calls it the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. Or maybe on a more fundamental level, it's just the drive for materialism, the drive for hedonism, the drive for ego. That ego that we all have that comes from that part of our personality, right? And we need to understand how we approach that struggle. But it doesn't help to hope and imagine that the struggle isn't there. That's what I want to go through, first of all. Because the struggle is there. It's there for a reason. In fact, the Talmud tells us that every day the struggle is there. Every day that evil drive, which we call it the Yetzer Hara, or the negative drive, or the drive of ego, tries to topple the human being. That's what the Talmud says. And yet every day we are able to access, if we want to, and if we try to, we're able to access God's help in overcoming that struggle. So it's not that God gives us a struggle and then lets us struggle. He gives us a struggle, but he gives us the strategy and he gives us the assistance and he energizes us with the will and the inner strength to be able to overcome the struggle. But the reason that the struggle is there, and there's many, many ways to approach this, but let me share with you just a quick inspirational idea from one of the weekly parashas, which is going to be coming up in a few weeks, where God commands Moses to tell the Jewish people to kindle the menorah every day in the temple, right? And the emphasis of that particular paragraph is, he says, let them bring olives and produce pure olive oil. And that pure olive oil will be then be used to kindle the candelabra every day in the temple. And we know that one of the ideas behind the menorah, behind the candelabra, was to just produce light that was a symbolic of strength and illumination and energy that would be spread throughout the world. In fact, the interesting thing, just a side issue, just to understand the purpose or the symbolism of that menorah, of that candelabra, when King Solomon built the temple, you know, if you've ever gone to the tunnel tours in Jerusalem, you'll know what I'm talking about. But the thickness of the walls that were used in the structure of the temple are amazing, right? It's an unbelievable. And those walls had windows. And in ancient times, they would build windows, because they didn't have electricity, of course, they would build windows that would be narrow on the outside and wide on the inside. The idea was that the light of the sun would come in and then spread to the outside. When King Solomon built the temple, he built it back to front. He built the windows in such a way where they were narrow in the inside and wide on the outside. Now, of course, that's not going to help in terms of sunlight, right? But the reason he did that was a very, very strong symbolism that the purpose of the temple was not to receive light, but the purpose of the temple in Jerusalem was to infuse the rest of the world with light, with energy, with inspiration, and so on and so forth. So the same thing with the menorah, the kindling of the menorah, of the candelabra that was done every day in the temple. The idea was to create a light that would ignite the souls which are compared to candles. And we are taught specifically in the Torah that the light of the olives had to be done with pure olive oil. And we are taught in the Talmud that olive oil produces the most pure and most beautiful light, symbolic of a purity and spirituality that was synonymous with the whole candelabra and the temple structure. Why am I sharing this with you? Because the Talmud also says that there's something interesting about olive oil. That olive oil can only be produced by crushing the olive. And the crushing of the olive is also part of the symbolism, because the crushing of the olive represents the inner struggle that we have often. And when we have that inner struggle and we overcome that struggle to the best of our ability, and we'll talk about that soon, we do grow and we sort of confront the weaknesses that we have in our personality, and we work on our weak dispositions, whatever they are, and they differ from person to person. We work on our anger, we work on our envy, we work on our judgmentalism, whatever the weakness is, we try to work on it and overcome. The strength that we achieve from that is far greater than strength and positivity that we would have without the struggle. And therefore, going back to the candelabra, we learn to understand this imagery that purity and pure light emerges from a crushed olive. That is specifically when we have the olive and we give it a bit of a kvetch, as they say in Yiddish, right? That produces oil that can produce the pure and beautiful and spiritual light of the candelabra. So that's something we need to bear in mind. Not to constantly wish that the struggle should go away, because it won't go away. Because we are born to grow. We are born to improve. We are born imperfect to become stronger and to develop a much deeper and stronger inner strength, and one of the ways that happens is through overcoming the things that stand in our way. And therefore, going back to the topic that we're talking about, often people complain, particularly in our distracting world, but particularly when we talk about letting go of negativity and when we talk about being present in the now, and often we've used the phrase about being fully present in the now means to let go of the worries of yesterday or the distractions of yesterday and the worries of tomorrow, the baggage of yesterday and the things that we worried about tomorrow. That's a difficult thing to do. It's difficult particularly because those thoughts intentionally bombard us, and sometimes based on our own ego and weaknesses and sort of get in our way and destroy what we're trying to do, And its purpose, of course, is not just to be there as a struggle. The purpose is to confront it, to know that it's there, understand that it's there, and yet fight it and overcome it. And just to take that a step further, to understand that the struggle is always there, sometimes, you know, we're able to sort of master a particular weakness. So let's say someone has a particular problem of a relationship issue or conflict with someone, and they overcome it and they liberate themselves and they're able to sort of let go of that negativity and be more positive. Or they used to be very, very judgmental, and they've kind of mastered the act of not being judgmental, which I haven't yet. It's hard to master completely, but let's say a person's making really real headway, right? We should understand that we never become perfect, because when we become perfect, we no longer need to be here. Like, as long as we're alive, there's room for growth, right? And that's very much hinted in a very interesting thing that the Torah tells us as well about, you know, as I mentioned last week, it's coming up to Pesach, not too far away, that when the Jews left Egypt, we've talked about this before, the exodus from Egypt is a representation of a spiritual exodus, a personal exodus. The word Mitzrayim, as I said, means Metzah, means borders, inner prison, and so on. And when the Jews left Egypt, they traveled through the desert. And towards the end of their journey, the Torah lists all the stops where they stopped until they got to the final destination, which was the land of Israel. And the term that the Torah uses is Eile Mas'ei B'nei Yisrael Asher Yatzu Meretz Mitzrayim. These are the journeys, in the plural, of the Jewish people when they left Egypt. Right? These are the Mas'ei. Mas'ei means journeys in the plural. And the commentaries ask the question, hold on a second, these are not journeys all of leaving Egypt. These are they only left Egypt once. They left destination number two and then destination number three. But they didn't leave, they left Egypt once. Egypt was only one of the locations. And the commentaries explain that, no, it doesn't work like that. It was all about leaving Egypt, because Egypt is relative. In other words, the Egypt of today is not the Egypt of tomorrow. In fact, it's the opposite way around. The exodus of today becomes the Egypt of tomorrow. What do I mean? When we overcome a struggle, when we overcome an inner personality weakness, when we overcome a distracting thought, whatever the case might be, so we've gone beyond ourselves, we've gone beyond our own prison, we've gone beyond our own comfort zone, we've grown into a new space, we've expanded. That level of expansion tomorrow becomes our comfort zone, and we have to go beyond that. So there's 42 journeys. The Baal Shem Tov used to explain that particular verse. He said that that's life. It represents the life journey. The life experience is, it's the number 42. That's a Kabbalistic idea, but whatever the number is not really relevant. It involves a multiple stages of journey, that whenever we master something, there's a new challenge, and that's fine. We just need to know that's when we understand and appreciate that, we don't get so turned off or so threatened by inner struggles, because we realize it's there for a purpose. It's there for us to grow, and we need to approach it that way. However, we shouldn't be afraid, because besides all the things we've been discussing till now, there are three things that we need to bear in mind. That's really the topic that I wanted to go through today, to understand those three important perspectives. The first thing is, to know that in terms of the struggle, it's achievable. In other words, we can master the struggle. We need to understand that if God gives us that particular weakness, whatever our weakness is, He only gives it to us because we can overcome it, because we can achieve success. And therefore, the second thing is that we never give up, even when we fail. And thirdly, we're going to talk about something which I'll explain it when we get there. We need to learn to strengthen the healthy muscles, and I'll show you what I mean in a minute. So let's just understand what it means that overcoming is achievable. I want to just share with you a cute story that this book that I've been reading and quoting a lot in the series, Russ Harris, he tells a very cute story that he was on a plane when he was writing the chapter about letting go and this concept which he develops in the book about understanding that the intruding thoughts will always be there, and you can't necessarily send them away, but you can let them be and not let them stand in and not let them bring you down. So he says, as he was writing this chapter in the book, he was on a plane. And he had his seat a bit back, and the guy behind him was had an empty seat next to him. And Anyway, he asked him to put his seat up, and he said, look, he can't because he's working on his computer, but maybe he can put his seat back, and or he can move to the next seat. In other words, the guy was very grumpy, and he wouldn't do that. So the guy says, okay, so I'll just have to make myself comfortable. And the guy behind him started to pound with his knee into his plane, into his seat. Right? So he thinks to himself, okay, what am I going to do here? I don't want to create a whole fight on the plane. But on the other hand, I'm not really just going to give in to someone's tantrum, right? Because he threw a tantrum. So he says, you know, I'm going to ride this out a little bit. So he finds a sort of the most comfortable position possible that he could. And he just lets it happen. And this car just is pounding and pounding. And after a few minutes, it stops. And then it starts again. Because, you know, every few minutes, the guy had to let him know that he hasn't forgotten. He did it in a very clever way. He didn't do it if there was any air hostess that came by or steward that came by. He didn't do it and so on. He says he was thinking about it as it was happening. He says, first of all, he found it a bit amusing, and then he found it a bit annoying. Then he started reflecting, which is always a good thing to do. And he says, you know, it's interesting. We all have these outbursts. Maybe we don't pound people's chairs, but we all have tantrums on our level where we kind of lose it a bit and so on and so forth. And then he sort of started reflecting. It's like a really unpleasant thing when you get caught up in your own anger and your own negativity, and it's, you know, that whole thing. Anyway, it went on for 20 minutes, and then it stopped. And then 10 minutes later, the guy leans over and he says, mate, I'm really, really sorry. I've had a really bad day. I don't know how I acted that way. I really, really apologize. He gives out his hand and they shake hands. So he says to him, he says, no worries. In fact, I'm actually very grateful to you. So the guy says, why? He says, because I'm busy writing a book and you're actually the next chapter. And I'm writing about you. He says, that's really great. Can you tell me what it's about? Anyway, he develops this whole thing based on this idea, right? And he starts developing an experiment which he is in line with the whole theory and in line with the whole diffusion concept that we talked about last week. And he develops this experiment. It's interesting. I'll share it with you because I found it quite insightful. He says, if you take a book, his experiment, he says, take the book that you're reading now, right? And hold it up and imagine it represents all the negative thoughts that are standing in your way, that are swirling around your head, that are standing in the way of you focusing and really being absorbed in what you're supposed to be doing. He says, the first thing you do is hold it up to your face so that you can't see anything. And just hold it there for a few minutes and begin to understand how frustrating it is and how you can't see anything. And then imagine as if those are your negative thoughts and your negative thinking patterns that are just paralyzing you and standing in your way, right? So you have that imagery. In other words, at that stage, what's happening is you're being controlled by your own thoughts and you paralyze and you can't do anything about it. Then he says, take the same book and hold it away from you, but like stretch out your arms very, very strongly and hold it away from you so they're not blinding you, they're not paralyzing you. But he says, interesting what happens after a while is it becomes incredibly tiresome to do that. It's very hard to keep holding a book like that, right? And his third experiment, he says, why don't you take the book and just put it on your lap and let it sit there and you get on with what you're doing, right? So his issue is like this. His theory is as follows. He says, you can either be controlled or you can control, but they're both not going to work. In other words, you can be controlled by your negative thoughts so that you just give in to your negative thoughts. You're dysfunctional. You're not achieving anything. You're being held back. You're being paralyzed. You're not being able to focus, being absorbed in the moment. And then you're not achieving what you want to achieve in life. You're not getting any meaning or purpose or inner fulfillment about what you're doing. The other method is to get really upset about your negative thinking patterns and to fight it, to try and control it rather than controlling you. But control it in a negative way where you're engaging with it and you're thinking about it the whole time, but you're pushing it away. I'm not going to let you stand in the way kind of thing, right? But that's also not going to work because then you're just being, sometimes being controlled and controlling is the same problem because it's all being controlled. You're engaging with negativity, right? The Talmud has a beautiful expression for this. It says, "Kol ha'osek im ha'manuvel misnavel." Anyone who engages with a low life becomes a low life. In other words, that's a loose translation. So, right? In other words, sometimes you engage with negativity head on, even if you're fighting it, but you're engaged with it. And we know this to be true in many, many aspects of life. Sometimes whenever you engage in something, even if you think you're fighting a good war, but you engage with a negative thing, it becomes a negative experience. So therefore, he says you need to go to the third way, which is putting on the lap and just getting on with it, which is the concept of expansion, he calls it. Which is basically to say, no problem, you want to be there. I know the struggle will always be there, but I'm going to put myself in a space where my focus becomes different. My focus becomes focusing on the goal, a little bit like I told you last week about being at the Yamsuf, being at the Red Sea, where there was four opinions about what to do, and even the opinion that said we should pray was wrong because God said you're being distracted from the goal. The goal is move on. There's distractions, the distractions are there. Don't pretend they're not there, they are there, but you focus on the goal. And I was thinking about it because I think it fits in very, very much to a very interesting piece of the Talmud, which I've called the strand of the hair on the mountain. And the reason I call it that was because that's what the Talmud says. The Talmud talks about this negative drive that we have within us, which is the drive that causes the struggle. Okay. And the Talmud says that this negative drive can sometimes be viewed as a strand of hair, which is very easy to snap and very easy just to ignore. It might sometimes annoy you, but it's easy to ignore. Or it can be seen as a mountain. And a mountain is something very confronting, very a tall mountain. It's very threatening. It can, like, you don't know where you'll be able to go. It's going to stand in your way. You'll never be able to navigate it, and so on and so forth. And the context of the Talmud's discussion is an interesting one because it talks about what will happen in the future. The Talmud discusses and describes the ultimate goal, the messianic era, where the struggle will come to an end. That will be the final destination, where we've achieved what we need to achieve, and God will bring in and usher in this utopian sort of period where we won't have the struggle because we would have overcome the struggle and the negative drive will be eliminated. But he says, the Talmud says, very interesting, that when that happens, those that worked to overcome the struggle, worked hard, will suddenly see the negative force as a mountain. And they'll think to themselves, wow, how did we manage to overcome such a struggle? Whereas those that were lazy and those that didn't engage in the struggle will suddenly see it like the strand of hair and will be disappointed. How come we weren't able to overcome the little strand of hair? Right? The idea being that both groups reversed it initially. In other words, the ones that engage with the struggle are the ones that say, it's difficult, but it's like a strand of hair. We can do it. We can let it live and we can get on with the goal, right? Eventually, their reward will be that they will see that it wasn't such a strand of hair. Actually, it was a difficult struggle and it was amazing that they were able to achieve that. Where those that initially approach it like a mountain and say, this is just too overwhelming and I can't do it, and why is this happening to me, and why did God give me such a personality, and why is it so difficult for me, and so on and so forth, eventually will be disappointed when they realize that there was a pathway to treat it like a strand of hair. And they'll think, why couldn't we do this, right? So our challenge is to see it now like a strand of hair, even, which means not to be naive, not to be in denial. The struggles are sometimes very difficult. I'm talking about the inner struggles are sometimes very difficult. The thought patterns, the negative thinking that stand in our way are sometimes very strong. And yet, we can do something about it. We can overcome it. That's the first perspective. However, we need to understand the next thing, and that is like this. Get to the half a shekel in a minute. We need to understand, what does it mean to overcome the struggle? And I think this is such a key issue that people struggle, this is self people struggle with. Overcoming the struggle means, does not mean, I should say, that it always works or that it works right away. And this is really, I think, the crux of the whole concept. If we're going through a bad patch, if we're going through a time of distraction, we're going through a time where we experience what we called a few weeks ago the reality gap, where we've just overcome with complete irritability and negative thinking patterns that are standing in our way, and we know we have to overcome it, and we know we have to do something about it, and we try and implement the strategies and it doesn't work, that becomes the greatest test of all. What happens is often that we then jump to a conclusion that it can't work. If it's not working, then it can't work. And that's our biggest test. And that's the biggest mistake. Because success in personal growth, we've said this many times in many different ways, but success in our personal development and our personal growth does not mean perfection all the time. And it does not mean 100% success record. And it does not mean that we overcome it and succeed every single time. It doesn't mean that. Because if it meant that, it wouldn't be much of a struggle. And it wouldn't be able to achieve the strength that it's supposed to achieve. The struggle means that it comes with its complications. That it is difficult. And it comes down to you've got to try and try again and never ever give up hope. And never think to ourselves that no matter how many mistakes we might have made, no matter how many times it didn't work, no matter how many times I promised myself I wasn't going to say that and I said it anyways, no matter how many times I promised myself I wasn't going to feel that way and I feel it anyway, right? Right? Sounds familiar? Yeah? We all do this. This is one of the great benefits of coming together is we find we're not isolated, right? We know we're all normal. We all sort of confront the same things, yeah? And people say that, you know, did it again. I promised myself 100 times that I'm not going to scream at that kid when, I don't know, whatever, and I slid it again, right? So you know what we need to understand? You know, we just read in the weekly parashas, it always gives a lot of inspiration. We read the story of the 10 plagues. And towards the end of the Maccas, and towards the end of the 10 plagues, God tells Moses, that go and warn Pharaoh about the next plague. I think it was a plague of locusts or hail, whatever it was. But he tells Moses, you know, I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart. I'm going to make it tough for him. Right? And the commentaries ask the question and say, hey, hold on a second. That's not exactly fair. If I come and warn you and I give you a choice, the choice has to be real. One of the fundamentals of Judaism is that we have free choice. Human beings have free choice in moral issues, right? In our moral decisions. We don't have free choice in terms of how the life works out. That's controlled by God. But we have free choice in terms of the moral decisions we make. Now, Pharaoh was called upon to make a moral decision, which was to release the Jewish people from slavery and let them go and serve God in the desert. And God said, listen, I'm bringing the plague, but you have a choice. You could prevent this plague by making the proper moral choice and letting the Jews go. But on the side, God tells Moses, listen, I'm going to harden his heart. I'm going to make it difficult for him to say yes. But that's not fair. And there's many, many approaches in this whole discussion. It's a very, very complicated theological discussion. One of the commentaries says the following. Most beautiful idea. That it is true that sometimes the struggle becomes more difficult when we are confronted with something where we should know what to do and we should know what choice to make and we don't time and time again. And sometimes, almost as a consequence of that, it becomes harder to make the right choice. True. Which is what God was saying. But the choice always remains, no matter how many times. Even a Pharaoh that has messed up 7 times at that point, and has said no 7 times, and God had made it more difficult for him to say yes, he still gets a legitimate warning from God because we have a choice. Because we can try again. Because there's always a door open. And in fact, this is even more emphasized with a fascinating story in the Talmud. It's one of my favorite stories, this one. There was a sage in the Talmud, a very rare thing happened. There was a great sage in the Talmud, his name was Rabbi Elisha ben Avuya. Now, generally, the sages of the Talmud were great men, great tzaddikim, great righteous people, Torah teachers, men of great wisdom and stature and piety and so on and so forth. So was this particular one, and he, in a very rare thing that happened in the Talmud, he lost his commitment towards the end of his life, and he went off the rails. He stopped observing Torah mitzvot, and he became a bit of a heretic. Why did it happen? It happened because of a whole interesting story. It happened because there were 4 of those sages. Rabbi Akiva was one of them, just to give you context. And they decided they're going to embark on a spiritual, esoteric, Kabbalistic journey and kind of expose themselves to explore the higher worlds, whatever that means. I've never been there, but whatever that means in a Kabbalistic sense. And they did this, whatever they did, some sort of transcendence or something, whatever the case was, and they were able to peek into what's happening in the himlin, as they say, in the heavens above. And for 3 of them, it didn't work. One of them died. One of them actually became mentally insane. And this particular one saw something he didn't understand, whatever the case was, and he gave up Judaism because of that. Okay? Only Rabbi Akiva, by the way, was the only one that went in one piece, that came out in one piece, and he grew from the experience. Okay, a separate discussion of what it was all about, and so on. Now, this particular sage, he became known afterwards as Acher. Now, his name was Rabbi Elisha ben Avuya, but he became known as Acher because Acher means someone else, because no one recognized him anymore. So they started to call him Acher. They couldn't believe it's the same person. So as one woman put it then, who met him and couldn't believe what she was saying, she says, no, it's not Rabbi Elisha ben Avoya, it's Acher, it's someone else. So it stuck, and he got the name called Acher. Now this Acher, he had a student, also one of the great sages of the Mishnah. His name is Rabbi Meir. And Rabbi Meir, an interesting discussion in his own right, although his teacher had given it all up, and Rabbi Meir hadn't, Rabbi Meir remained a very devout Jew, Rabbi Meir continued to study with Acher. Acher still remained a scholar. He didn't forget his scholarship. He still remained a great Torah scholar. And Rabbi Meir said, I still want to learn from you. And the Talmud discusses, is that permitted actually to do that? And the conclusion was that Rabbi Meir was careful enough and he knew how to filter it. He knew what to take and what not to take, so it was fine. So Rabbi Meir is walking with this Acher one Shabbat. And they were discussing. And a whole story happens, a whole discussion. And eventually Rabbi Meir turns to his teacher Acher and says to him, I plead with you. I'll continue learning with you regardless, but chazor becha, come back. Like, stop being silly. You've lived your whole life with such purity, with such piety. You've done such good things. You've done such amazing accomplishments in your life. Don't give in to your weaknesses. Come back. Do tshuva. Repent. Return. Reconnect. So he says to him, I can't. You know why? He says, because when I was in the higher heavens, or some say he heard a heavenly voice in the temple, whatever the different version was, the point was he heard a voice coming out from heaven that said the following. Listen to this. The voice said from heaven, Shuvu banim shavavim, which is a verse that says, return naughty children, essentially. In other words, God was saying that there's this concept of, you know, you can always fix your mistake. That's the whole theme of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. You can always fix, you can always reconnect, you can always, even if you made a mistake, even if you failed, you can always come back. And the voice was a voice of a call to tshuva, a call to repentance, and the voice said, Chutz me'acher, except for Acher. God said, I don't want him back. So Acher says, I can't come back. So Rabbi Meir continues to say, no, he says, no, you got to. And he tries, and he keeps trying, and he keeps trying, and he keeps trying, unsuccessfully. So the commentaries ask the question, how can Rabbi Meir continue to try? Wasn't that a good answer? If Acher said to him, listen, I can't come back because God doesn't want me back, so why did Rabbi Meir keep trying? And the commentaries explain the most amazing thing. The commentaries explain and say that Acher should have come back regardless. He should have said, no, I'm coming back. Why? Because there's a law, listen to this, there's a law of hospitality. Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, these are all areas of life. One of the areas of life is hospitality, when someone invites you to their home. It says, Kol ma shebalabayit omer asei, which means whatever the host of the house tells you to do, you have to listen. That's etiquette. Where they want you to sit, where they want you to, whatever. Generally, when you're someone's home, whatever the host of the house asks you to do, you should do. Chutz mitzei, with the exception if he kicks you out. You don't have to listen. If he said, obviously if he invites you for 2 hours and you extend your stay for 3 weeks, that might be a bit different, right? But if someone welcomes you into his house, and then suddenly in the middle of the meal he changes his mood and he says, you know, I've changed my mind, get out of my house, right? You don't have to listen. That's what it says. So the commentaries say that Acher should have understood that God, who is the host of all of us, can tell us to do whatever he can tell us to do, but he's bound by his own laws and he cannot tell us to go out. He cannot tell Acher, don't come back. So the commentary said, then the obvious question is, so God also knows this, right? He also knows this. So why did he tell Acher no? Why did he say chutz ma'acher? Why did he say except for Acher? Everyone can come back except for Acher? The answer is, that was Acher's test. In other words, God did make it more difficult for him, it's true. But his test was, and the test of all of us is, that no matter how difficult it appears to be, and no matter how many times we think we made a mistake, and no matter how many times we think we failed, we have to and can try again. Why? Because if the millionth time we succeed, that's amazing success. It doesn't matter how long it takes, as long as we try. Because that's what personal growth is. That's what growing is. Growing is giving it our best shot. And that comes to this picture because this coming week, we're going to read in the Torah an interesting mitzvah. the mitzvah of machatzit hashekel. It's one of the four special portions we do around this time of the year. That we read about a mitzvah that was a yearly tax in the time of the temple, that they used to give every year a half a shekel. And a very interesting description the Torah gives of this half a shekel, the Torah says that you have to give, everyone had to give this half coin. It had to be specifically half. The rich couldn't give more, the poor couldn't give less, it had to be half. And then the Torah says, interesting thing, that the Torah is describing the currency and says that this half a shekel was made up of a currency called Gera. You know, like a dollar is 100 cents. This machzit shekel was made up of a currency called Gera. In other words, many Geras made up a shekel, right? How many Geras in a shekel, in a whole shekel? 20. The Torah says you should give half a shekel, and in the half a shekel, there's 10 Gera. Okay? So the commentaries explain there's an unbelievable lesson here. We know that 10 is a complete number because it's 10 powers of our soul, right? 10 is a complete number. Yet the mitzvah is about half a shekel. Why? It's a beautiful message. The Torah says you don't have to be perfect. You don't have to be complete. You don't have to reach completion. But you have to give it all you got. You got to give it all 10 powers of your soul. You got to try and give everything of you in it. It might not work the first time. You might be incomplete. You might be less than half even. But you know there's Eser Gera. You've given it the 10 Gera. You've given the 10 powers of your soul because you're really trying to give it your full attempt. It might not work the first time. It might work and then not work. We might succeed tomorrow and then not succeed the next day. We've gone through this before. Something good is eternal. It doesn't get negated. It doesn't get discounted because we succeeded day one and then failed day two. Right? So I'm saying that in context of the struggle. We need to know the struggle is achievable. We can overcome it. We can grow. But growth doesn't always mean getting it right all the time. And that's fine. And growth doesn't mean getting to a full shekel. We don't have to get to a full shekel. As I've said many times, we might minimize, you know, you said, I said to myself, I'm not going to say that 10 times and I said it again, but maybe I say it less now. Maybe the thing I promised myself I wasn't going to say, I still say it, but I do it less. Maybe the thing, maybe the thoughts that I tried to get on top of, maybe the thoughts that I tried to let go of, I succeeded a bit more of letting go of them. Maybe I still worry a lot, but not as much as last week. Not as much as last month. Maybe I still have resentment that's standing in the way and distracting me from getting on with what I'm supposed to be focused on, but I have less. I can focus more on some days. I can be absorbed in the now more days than I used to be able to. It's a progress. It's a process. It's a journey. We don't have to get it right. We just have to try. We have to try and put the 10 Gera into it, the 10 powers of the soul. We have to try and put everything we have into it. But we still might be machzit, we still might be half. And that's fine because God doesn't count the perfection. He counts the journey. He counts the effort. He counts the growth that we try and engage in. As long as we try to keep growing, as long as we always try and take the next step, that's what counts. So I say that because sometimes the struggle does become overwhelming. But part of the reason the inner struggle becomes overwhelming is because we misinterpret the definition of success. We think getting on top of the struggle means to get it right all the time, and that's a mistake. We have to understand that no matter how many times we fail, there's always a way back, and we have to understand that no matter how imperfect it is, as long as we're giving it our 10 Gera, the 10 powers of the soul, we're okay. And finally, I wanted to just deal, we're running a little bit out of time, maybe I'll start it now and continue on next week, but I wanted to deal with a very, very important concept. And that is what I've called strengthening the healthy muscles. Right. In dealing with our own health, in physical health, we find two concepts, right? Often when something's wrong with us and we seek medical treatment, there's often two levels of treatment. One is where we deal with the disease, we deal with the problem. But we know, and I think we know more today than we used to know it, we also deal with a part of us that's healthy, general health. Because often when we have a particular issue in one particular area of our health, the stronger we are in the rest of us, we get on top of that particular weakness quicker, right? So we do more exercise and we eat better and so on and so forth. And then we have a problem, it's easier to deal with the problem than if we're generally unhealthy. Now, life goes up and down, right? We're not continuously in one long negative struggle. But life does go up and down. And particularly in the context of our discussion, we don't always have these moments of distraction. We don't always have days where things go all wrong. Sometimes we have days with just minimal regular struggles, but we go on and things work out pretty okay. And then suddenly we get a knock and we get something goes haywire, or something happens with another person, or something happens outside of us, or something, someone said something to us or did something to us, and then we go through a period where we're distracted with all these intruding thoughts, as we've been talking about. Besides the strategies that we spoke about last week, about how to deal with those negative thoughts, whether disputing them or disengaging with them and so on, one of the things we have to learn to do is, when things are going more or less okay, is to strengthen the parts that are okay. In other words, strengthen the times that are healthy and build up those muscles, so to speak, that when the challenge comes, we're better equipped and stronger to focus and to be mindful and to be, and not let that negative thinking pattern stand in the way. Does that make sense? Yeah? There's a beautiful interpretation, which I think I might have shared with you once. It comes from the previous chief rabbi of England, Lord Jacobowitz. And I put that verse, and there's a verse in Hebrew which we say in Psalms. We say it actually on Friday night. It says, "Lehagid baboker chasdecha ve'emunatcha balaylot," which means that King David hoped and he said to God, "I would love to tell, to convey his kindness," meaning God's kindness in the morning, "and his faith at night." He says, what does this mean? So he said like this. He said that everyone in our lives, we've got two parts of our life. We've got the daytime, we've got the nighttime. Some days are more like morning, others are more like night. Morning is bright, hopeful, positive. Night is dark and more negative. So King David said, you know what I'd like to do? I would like to focus. I don't want to wait for the night. I would like to focus on his kindness, God's kindness, and convey his kindness and connect to him when it's daytime, when it's easier to connect to him, to strengthen and build up my connection with him, so that balaylot, so that when it becomes nighttime, I can have the faith. In other words, the more I strengthen my connection to God when things are going well, the more equipped I will be to have the faith when it's night. If I don't work on the healthy muscles, if I don't work on the healthy periods of time, then suddenly when I'm confronted with a challenge, I'm not able to do it, right? Or it becomes more difficult to do it, put it that way. Now, that's not to say that challenge itself doesn't bring out the strength sometimes, but it's easier to embark on that journey when we strengthen our connection when things are going well. And therefore, there are a number of different things that we can do, putting it back in now into the whole context and discussion of mindfulness and put it into focus, right? When we're just going through a regular day of distraction just because it's just regular life, right? There are things we can do to build up those mindfulness muscles, so to speak, that they become as strong as possible, so that when suddenly we do confront a challenge, when suddenly we go through a patch where we're all over the place and we have all this negative thinking that's bombarding us and threatening us and blocking us and standing in the way, it becomes easier to let them go or to get on top of it. Let's give a couple of examples. In Jewish thought, we have a concept we've talked about many times called bitachon, which is trust. Essentially, what is trust? Trust in God, I'm talking about. It's letting go, remembering that we're not in control, and remembering that surrendering is not a weakness, but surrendering is actually a strength. To understand, just to stand back and let God run the world, right? Now, when things happen that are challenging, whether someone's ill or we're worried about a business interview or whatever the case is, and we worry a lot, we can talk about trust then, but it's very difficult because we have real worry and we kind of are worried. And part of that worry is because we think we're in control and we think we can make it turn out right, and we're worried maybe we're not going to. So it's very difficult to surrender at that point. But what we can do is, when things are just cruising along, we can remember and try and strengthen that muscle of surrender with small things, things that are manageable, like looking for ways every day to give up control. Now, for some of us, that's a hard thing to do. Some of us are in control mode 24 hours a day. Okay, you don't have to own up. It's okay. It's right. But there are little things in life where we don't have to. We can just You know, let someone else then, let someone else go first. I mean, not figuratively speaking. Let someone else's opinion, maybe they've got a different way of doing it. You know, maybe just say, that's an interesting approach. Let's try it your way. Look for things in life to give up a little bit of control. So that when we really have a challenge, and giving up control is a big part of letting go, a big part of the ability to focus on the moment and focus on the now, because often what happens is we're hanging on to a million things and we can't focus on the now because we need to control and manipulate so many things of yesterday and so many things of tomorrow, so it's impossible to focus on what's going on now. And what we need to do is learn to give up and let go. We need to strengthen that muscle when we're able to strengthen that muscle. We need to strengthen the muscle when things are going just on a regular day. To wake up in the morning and just to understand, let's let go. Let's look for ways today to let go a little bit. Let's look for ways to let go and let other people, not as parents, for example, we learn to let go. We don't have to say no all the time. We don't have control over what our children are doing. We can wait for the important things and let go. It's a difficult thing to do. It sounds easy, but actually every single day, if you think about it, on a regular day, there are things that we try to control where we can just let go. And if we let go, we strengthen that muscle of letting go. Another one is patience. Part of mindfulness is patience is a very, very big part of actually just being patient and being letting ourselves live in every moment. Now, that's a thing we need to practice on its own. We need to every day set us time to practice patience. Patience means to do things slowly. Not when we're in a hurry or we're stressed out or people are annoying us, but just to regularly practice patience. Just to practice doing things slowly, mindfully, properly. It's a hard thing to do for some of us, but just to practice that and to strengthen that muscle so that when we are stressed out, it's easier to put into practice. Gratitude is a big one. Why? Because we've talked about many times that the concept of gratitude brings awareness. And that's a concept to do every single day. We need to practice our gratitude muscle. We need to strengthen that muscle, which is so beneficial and contributes so strongly to the concept of mindfulness. To learn every day, to set aside time every day, to remember the blessings that we have, to look for positive things, whether it's through the Modani in the morning or the morning blessings or just generally during the day, to stop and think about good things that happen today, to become aware of the things that go unnoticed and the things that are so easy to miss. That's a practice, that's a muscle that needs to be strengthened every single day. Finally, another example is the concept of judgment. One of the great impediments to mindfulness is the concept of judging. Remember, we talked about being present at the moment non-judgmentally, which means, in other words, to have a completely fresh approach to the full potential of this moment without judging it through the experiences of yesterday and experiences of tomorrow. But judgment is a very difficult thing to get over because we all judge. We judge ourselves, we judge other people, we judge events, we jump to conclusions. One of the muscles we need to learn to strengthen is that concept of not being judgmental. And we can practice it just with things that don't matter so much. With things that aren't so, you know, it's very hard to practice it when someone does something to you and you judge it negatively and suddenly, no, I shouldn't be so judgmental, but I'm very emotionally involved already by then, so I'm judging. But we need to practice not being so judgmental just when things aren't so emotionally involved. When it's something that someone said that's nothing to do with me, I'm not even involved in it. But just to have an interpretation, to learn to question ourselves, so who said I'm judging it correctly? Who said my negative interpretation of that is correct? Maybe there's a different way to look at it. And just the things that happen to us during the day that don't matter one way or another, but yet we have judged them, to learn to strengthen that muscle of not being judgmental. When we do that in times where we don't need so much focus, in times where we are not challenged that much, the more we strengthen these muscles, the more we can put them into practice when we do go through a time of inner struggle. This needs to be elaborated a bit more. Maybe we'll do this next week a little bit as well. But just in summary, the struggle is there, but it's there for a purpose. It's there to produce the pure olive oil. We shouldn't be put off with it. We should understand that it's achievable, but at the same time, understand what the definition of success is, understand that we need to keep on trying no matter what happens, and to learn also to strengthen those healthy muscles that we have so that we can fight back and overcome when in times of challenge. Have a great day and a great week. Just a reminder, we have 2 more weeks before I go overseas. And we'll elaborate a bit.